Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss America's debt ceiling with Congresswoman Donna Edwards and Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey. We'll also discuss personal finance tips for federal employees with First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill, as well as AFGE's historic TSA election win with Local 777 President Ricky McCoy. Up first, Congresswoman Donna Edwards, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, Congresswoman, there has been a lot of conversation about the debt ceiling and whether to increase it and at what price. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, here's what your listeners should know. Number one, the United States has to pay its obligations. I mean, the debt ceiling is about paying bills that we already owe, not making new bills. And we all understand, because we do our own finances at home, that it's important to pay what you owe. And that's the issue that's at stake, and whether the United States is going to be viewed as a nation that pays its bills or not. And the entire, not just our economy, but the global economy hinges on our being able to do that.
What's the risk of not increasing the debt ceiling at this time?
Well, I think, what we know is that we're already in a fragile economy, both here in the United States and actually across the country for all of the, sort of problems of the last decade. And if the United States doesn't meet its obligations, there are a couple of things that will happen. It's been called default, and so that's what would happen. It would mean that it would throw us into an entire, financial tailspin and crisis. It would mean, for example, that our interest rates on the debt that we already owe would actually go up, and so that would make it more difficult than to pay our bills, our obligations. It would mean that it would throw the financial markets in crisis when they already went through a crisis 2 years ago. And, we haven't seen anything yet. And I think, so those people who are pushing this idea that somehow it doesn't matter, they are so wrong about that. And for individuals like, our listeners, what it would mean for them is that their interest rates on things like home mortgages, their credit cards, their ability to buy a car, all of those kind of day-to-day things would skyrocket because of the cost of credit, just because the United States didn't meet its obligations. And so this would be really irresponsible. America is not irresponsible. Americans are not irresponsible. And it's time for the Congress to get with it and raise the debt ceiling, get it to the president and sign it, and then move on with the nation's business.
It was reported earlier this week that the president might allow some cuts to Medicare and Medicaid in order to reach a compromise. As a member of the House of Representatives, what do you know about this?
Well, I've seen the same reports. I think that would be very unfortunate. The reality is that when we passed the Affordable Care Act last year, that's the health care reform bill, we actually ended up creating savings in the Medicare system. And so I think that there are other things that we can do, for example, closing corporate tax loopholes, ending the tax breaks, the tax cuts that are enjoyed by the wealthiest 2% of Americans. Those kind of things can be done that would literally save us, billions of dollars and not have to go at the kinds of things that are important for America's middle class, for our seniors, for our most vulnerable population.
It seems as if possibly some of your colleagues in the House of Representatives have still maintained that tax increases are off the table. Would you be willing to support any sort of compromise where that wasn't included?
Well, let's be clear about the so-called tax increases. I mean, it's sort of unfortunate that things like, tax breaks for oil and gas companies, essentially American taxpayers subsidizing oil companies that are making billions in profits, gets described as a tax increase. It's not. It's taking away a subsidy that the American public is providing for oil companies. Cuts that were provided for the wealthiest 2%, for people making, over $1 million, that were not paid for at all, things like that, increasing our debt. Taking that away is not a tax increase. It's just saying you're not going to get the benefit of what amounts to a taxpayer subsidy for all the rest of us because you happen to be in the wealthiest 2%. And so I think that we have to be clear about our language, and you can't, you know, on one hand say that the American middle class, which is already really struggling and which has seen, you know, a decade long of sliding wages, should have to bear the brunt of that because oil companies don't want to give up their subsidies.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Congresswoman Donna Edwards about the debate over the debt ceiling. Congresswoman, what would it look like if we made significant cuts to Medicare and Medicaid? How would that impact the people who rely on those services?
Well, I think it would impact people tremendously. And keep in mind, again, that people have paid, Americans have actually paid into the Medicare system. It's not something that we just get for free. All of us who work every single day for all of our lives pay into that system. Our seniors get to enjoy the benefits of having worked for many decades in some cases paying into Medicare and now reap the benefits of that because they need medical care in their old age. Those who are disabled, all of us pay into that system. And so I think for America's most vulnerable, when you don't increase the debt ceiling, you make the United States a credit risk, you actually put in jeopardy the most vulnerable population.
Congresswoman, in your district, in the 4th District in Maryland, there are a large number of federal employees. What are they saying to you about this conversation that's going on Capitol Hill right now?
Well, they are just like Americans all across the country. They don't understand why it is in Congress and with the president. We can't do what has been actually fairly routine in other presidencies and other Congresses, which is to increase the debt ceiling as we need, one, not to rack up more bills, but to pay the bills that we already owe and to make sure that the world understands that the United States stands behind its obligations. And so they're kind of looking at this, the people in the 4th District, just like others are looking at it across the country and saying, you know, Congress, get on with it. That's your job. Increase the debt ceiling, deal with our budget issues, take care of our fiscal issues, but make sure that we don't jeopardize the most vulnerable.
There's also been talk of trying to push through a short-term deal. Is that a good idea?
No, I don't think it is at all. I think it is just as the president has described, kicking the can, you know, down the road. I mean, we have a responsibility right now. We have an obligation now. We've known that we've had this obligation for some time, and merely pushing it down to another day doesn't mean that we're going to deal with it responsibly or effectively. It's time for us to do our job now, to get on with it, to work every single day, if need be, between now and August 2nd, to get that deal done. I would say to Speaker Boehner and to those who lead this Congress, don't let us take another day off. The American public doesn't get to take a day off. We shouldn't take another day off at all. We should get this done. We should do it responsibly, raise the debt ceiling, and get on with America's business.
Congresswoman Donna Edwards from Maryland's 4th District, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll be joined by Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey to continue our discussion on the debt ceiling.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, welcome back to the program.
Great to be on, and good to be talking to you and your audience.
Roger, it appears that the president may be willing to make cuts to Medicare and Medicaid to get a deal passed on the debt ceiling. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, this amounts, if it's true, and we've got to make sure that it's not true, cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid would be the equivalent of giving in to blackmail. The conservatives have made it absolutely clear that they are unwilling to ask sacrifice of the wealthiest Americans who are still enjoying the Bush tax cuts. But they are demanding that the president do cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, and they've already done damage to Social Security, as people in your union know, and threatened to change the indexing by which Social Security benefits are calculated, the so-called chain CPI. Those would all be really counterproductive measures, and it wouldn't really get to the real causes of the federal deficit. So we're working with AFGE and other groups to send a message to the White House not to capitulate to this kind of blackmail.
Roger, what are the real causes of the federal deficit?
Well, people will remember that before George Bush came to office, the federal government was running a surplus. During the Clinton years, we not only had healthy economic growth, but we had higher levels of taxation for the wealthy. Bush came in, cut taxes dramatically for the wealthy, and then because of the economic crisis and the financial meltdown, the economy went bad. So the fact that unemployment is at 9% and rising, actually, that's the major driving cause of the deficit, along with the continued tax cuts for the wealthy and the spending on two wars that were not officially in the budget. If we would only reverse those factors, if we got the economy going, raise taxes on the wealthy, and cut back on military spending, the immediate threat of deficits would be taken care of.
Roger, during tough economic times like we're facing now, cutting $1 trillion from the budget or $2 trillion from the budget may sound good, but what does that do for the services that are cut, like Medicare, like Medicaid?
Well, the fact is the economy is very weak, and anybody looking for a job or have friends who are looking for a job know that millions of people are unemployed, and cutting back on public investment, public spending at this time, which is already happening at the state level, but doing it at the federal level on top of that just ensures that we won't get back to a healthy growth. We won't get people employed. So whatever plans for deficit reduction get hatched in this negotiation, they ought to be put off for a couple of years until the economy is robustly growing. And we really ought to be spending money now on things like public infrastructure and public jobs in order to goose the economy along and get us growing at a 4 or 5% growth rate. once we have jobs growing, once we have people employed and paying taxes, it'll be much, much easier to balance our books and have a balanced fiscal situation. But as long as the economy is bad, cutting government spending is just going to hurt the overall health of the economy.
Roger, that's an interesting point, and I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit, the idea of spending a little more money now to put the country in a better position going forward, as opposed to making cuts to these services that people rely on.
It's just common sense. People know that if we start cutting back on public employment, if we start reducing spending programs, if we don't continue to pay out unemployment claims, we're simply condemning ourselves to a slow growth economy. The stimulus that we had in the early days of the Obama administration is pretty much done, and some in Congress are now talking about a second round of investment in infrastructure and other programs that would get the economy moving, get employment up, and get Americans paying taxes into the system again. If we don't do that, if we instead cut back on Medicare and Medicaid, if we cut back on public spending, we're taking the stimulus out of the economy. We're condemning really the economy to a and all Americans to a decade of high levels of unemployment, which of course does nothing good for the federal deficit. So we really ought to be getting the economy growing again, and then raising taxes and cutting the military and doing all the other things that need to be done for long-term balance.
Roger, you just mentioned another point here to the deficit reduction, getting the country back on the right track. And the one side of it is, you know, ideas to cut spending, but on the other side is to enhance revenue. I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, this higher taxation level and maybe any ideas surrounding that.
Well, right now, the Obama administration is talking to Republicans, demanding at least that we cut back on some of the loopholes that corporations and wealthy people take advantage of to reduce their taxation. Things like tax breaks for jet airplanes that the executives use, other loopholes that cause Americans to keep their profits abroad and not bring them home. Those kind of loopholes are, you know, they're not huge, but we think that any deficit reduction plan ought to be at least 50-50, closing the loopholes, raising taxes on the one hand, and 50% budget cuts. The Republicans have been adamantly against that kind of tax increases or revenue enhancements or whatever you want to call them. And, of course, we think that we all also ought to be talking about rolling back the Bush tax cuts on people making more than $250,000 a year. If we did that, that would get $60 or $70 billion a year in added revenue that we could use to fill the deficit gap. And it would be much preferable to cutting back on nursing homes for the elderly.
Roger, you mentioned earlier about the manufacturing infrastructure idea that we have here. Is that really the way that you think we'll be able to kickstart this economy, providing people with good paying jobs that they can make a career out of?
We need to do something. We need to make sure that this economic recovery, which is very weak, doesn't stall out and we don't fall back into recession. The advantage of infrastructure is that everyone has documented that there's a need for rebuilding our roads and bridges and our transportation systems. Those things are waiting to be done. And if we don't do them now, we're going to have to do them in 10 years. So investing in infrastructure is one of the best ways to both get the economy more productive, because things can travel better and communications is better, and at the same time put people to work in real jobs, jobs that people can respect and see as beneficial to the nation. I also think we ought to be spending money on public service jobs in communities that are high levels of unemployment right now. But right now, all of those kind of things are off the table. This deficit mania is preventing us from getting our economy growing, and that's why the members of Congress that are now talking about big investment plans in infrastructure, sometimes they propose creating a bank that can take advantage of the low interest rates right now and spend the money that we need to spend. Those members of Congress need our support. They need to hear from people that say, yeah, that's a common sense way to get the economy growing and get the economy more productive.
Roger, why did the infrastructure and manufacturing sector slip in this country?
Well, it's manufacturing is a case of outsourcing to foreign countries, low-wage countries, sometimes encouraged by government policies and tax policies. It's starting to come back, but we're not doing enough to help American manufacturers make the decision to locate their production here in the U.S. And we need an industrial policy, a make it in America policy, just like most other countries have, to encourage their industry. And we need to stand up to the Chinese, who are manipulating their currency and making it easier to buy Chinese goods than American goods. Infrastructure is a matter of the politicians not doing their job. The public infrastructure is something that every private sector company depends on, roads and bridges and communication systems, and we've just been neglecting those important areas of investment for a long, long time. Every study shows that when you invest in infrastructure, when you invest in roads and bridges, the economy benefits. And one of the things that we need to do is generate the revenue to pay for that kind of infrastructure over the long term. But right now, we ought to be putting people to work and getting the benefit of those jobs.
The clock is ticking on the debt ceiling. Roger, do you believe that the debt ceiling will be raised? And if so, what will the ultimate deal look like?
Well, it's really important that Americans weigh in with the Obama administration and with members of Congress and tell them that we don't want, on the one hand, we don't want them to carry out their threat, Republicans, to carry out their threat to destabilize the federal government and its finances. This is the one place in the world where people send their dollars because they think it's a safe place to invest. And if the U.S. Government doesn't raise the debt ceiling, that stability is going to be undermined. So that's a threat that is affecting everybody if the Republicans actually pull the trigger. And then we need to make sure that a deal doesn't involve cuts to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And that's why we were proud to work with the AFGE and other groups to send a message to President Obama to stay strong and to defend those programs and to let the American people know that we'd rather see taxes on the wealthy rather than undermining those important programs that we all depend on. It's very important that we all share our views with members of Congress and to the White House as soon as we can, because, as you say, the clock is ticking.
Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. Roger, as always, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about personal finance tips for federal employees with First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. Good to be with you.
Bob, the U.S. is still feeling the effects of the Great Recession, with many people unemployed and trying to make ends meet. How has this impacted retirement planning and savings?
Jason, First Command conducts a Financial Behaviors Index, a survey of 1,000 Americans, and we do this monthly. And we supplement that then twice a year with 400 federal employees to learn more about their behaviors when it comes to financial matters. And what we're finding is that federal employees are becoming more frugal, actually more frugal than our other middle-income Americans. And this takes different forms and shapes. For example, federal employees are putting more money aside to pay down debt than our other Americans. And we've seen from the end of, from the beginning of 2010 to the end of 2010, that actually increased by 5%. That's a significant amount. In addition, federal employees are putting more dollars aside into their savings and retirement plans than our other middle-income Americans. And we've seen a sizable increase in that amount that they are contributing toward their futures.
Did the Financial Behaviors Index give any indication as to why federal employees were saving more than the rest of the population?
What we're learning, Jason, from both the index, the survey index, as well as from sitting down and talking with federal employees, is that they realize that it's really up to them to plan for their financial futures, because there's so much uncertainty, as you well know, with regards to their employment. The fact that they've seen their salaries frozen for 2 years, there's talk of recalculating how their annuity will be paid to them from high three to high five. And so those uncertainties are reasons we think that federal employees are taking action and taking action now to improve their overall situation.
On the topic of some of these challenges, how do you think federal employees would be best served to overcome them?
We think that, and again, the index shows this, that federal employees who have a financial plan are the ones who are more comfortable and confident about their financial futures. We found that 21% of federal employees have a financial plan, and their confidence level about the future was significantly higher than federal employees who didn't have a plan.
So first and foremost, one needs a plan. Let's talk now about what actually goes into that plan.
Well, certainly. We think it's important for federal employees to sit down with an advisor, to review what they have in their compensation plan. What do they have with, for example, thrift savings plan, federal employee group life insurance, and the other benefits that come with being a federal employee? We want to take those benefits into account as we help them to chart a path. That path is really based on what's important to them. We think there are what we call three cardinal cornerstones in a financial plan to include risk management, cash management, and wealth accumulation and management. So, again, using the benefits that a federal employee has and then supplementing them with other products or services inside of a financial plan really, in our opinion, makes the difference. And one of the reasons that the Financial Behaviors Index is showing that people with a plan are more confident about the future than others.
So let's go through some of these steps, these pillars. Start out first with risk management.
Risk management includes automobile insurance, homeowners or renters insurance. And so as you can appreciate, some of those are required by law. But the question is, do you have enough of that coverage based on your situation? We also talk with our clients, federal employee clients, about disability income insurance, because if you don't have an income, the rest of your financial plan really doesn't matter. And what federal employees are finding is that their disability income benefit within their, the federal government compensation plan is really a soft spot, and they want to take action to improve that situation. As you can appreciate, we just concluded the federal long-term care insurance program open season, and long-term care is another part of risk management. And finally, life insurance is the other part of risk management. And while federal employees have federal employee group life insurance, many of them find that that's not enough coverage for their family's financial needs, and that's a reason that we have a discussion about the risk management cornerstone to their plan.
And then on to cash management. Get into that a little bit.
All of us, from time to time, have emergencies and unexpected expenses. And so having an amount on hand that you feel comfortable with, we think is very important, so that you'll be able to pay off the unexpected expenses that we all incur from time to time, as well as to plan ahead for other expenses such as vacations or furniture for the home, those types of things, and being able to pay for those expenses with cash rather than putting those charges on credit and getting over your head in credit. And that's the reason that cash management is important for all of us.
Is there a formula that one should adhere to when allocating dollars to risk management, allocating dollars to cash management, and then, of course, to investments?
We think that all federal employees would be well served to consider what we call a 5-5-10 approach, with 5% of their gross dollars on a monthly basis going into risk management, 5% into cash management, and at least 10% on a monthly basis into their long-term investments. That's a simple but effective way for people to plan as to how much they will allocate into each of the three cornerstones.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Bob Hill, District Advisor of First Command Financial Services. Bob, what about the federal employee who says, I'm not an investment pro, I don't really know which choices to make?
I hear that quite often from individuals, and again, that may be a reason to sit down with a professional and talk about the different options and opportunities that are available. But if nothing else, Jason, I would say that they need to take advantage of the Thrift Savings Plan, because that's a great way for all federal employees to put a portion of their monthly or per pay period salary into a plan that is for retirement, and at the same time, it's basically out of sight, out of mind, because that's an automatic withdrawal from their salary. It will go into an account that will allow them to grow. And, of course, the important part there, as you well know, is that up to the first 5% of salary that federal employees do put into their Thrift Savings Plan account is matched by the federal government. So we all want free money, and that's a great reason why they should be contributing, when they can, at least up to 5% of their salaries into TSP.
Sure, as you said, it's hard to turn down free money, and if you can at least match that, then you're going to put yourself in a good position going forward.
That's right, and that's what we see, and that's what we encourage our federal employee clients to do, is to take advantage of the contribution that the federal government is going to make, your employer is going to make in your behalf, And again, earlier, as you said, even if you don't have a lot of expertise or understanding of the markets, putting some dollars aside for the future is, of course, very important. We can have discussions with our clients and should have discussions about how much risk they're willing to take, which will help them to determine which of the different TSP accounts or funds that they should contribute to.
When you sit down and talk to federal employees about planning out their financial futures, what are some of the biggest concerns that come up?
I think that one of the things that's universal is making sure that they do have enough money when they decide to retire. Will I be able to retire when I want to? And that is really having an understanding of how much annuity they will receive at the time of retirement, as well as what other accounts or what other dollars are going to be available to make sure that they have enough dollars to maintain their standard of living and quality of life. That's key, I think. In addition, federal employees and other Americans want to know what benefits are going to be there, such as their federal employee health benefits, federal employee group life insurance, and those types of benefits. What will the cost be for those benefits in the future? And again, will they have enough money to live comfortably and do the many things that they've been dreaming about and thinking about all these years, but have postponed because of work?
As you mentioned earlier, and as we well know here on Inside Government, federal employees are under a two-year pay freeze. Their health premiums continue to rise every year. Continuing, the situation looks difficult for federal employees. How would you suggest to a federal employee to overcome those obstacles and continue to focus on that long-term goal?
Well, fortunately, the Financial Behaviors Index indicates that, in fact, federal employees, for the most part, are doing just what you're talking about. They're taking control of the situation, and I think that's what all Americans need to consider as we consider the constraints and the attacks that are on benefits now and in the future. So the point is doing what you can as soon as you can and consistently doing it over a long period of time are keys to being successful financially.
Let's shift gears for a minute and talk about those who are at or nearing retirement. As you know, the federal government is looking at a wave of retirees coming soon. Those people obviously need to be replaced with newer workers. But for those who are at that retirement age, how do you guide them going forward into that retirement?
It's a great question, Jason. And what we do is to sit down with these individuals and talk about the cash flow that they're going to have on a monthly basis, again, based on their annuity, retirement accounts that they have, whether it's thrift savings plan, individual retirement accounts, or other revenue that they may have, other assets that they may have, and making honest assessments as to whether or not they will be able to enjoy life the way they want to. And so I think it really requires a financial advisor to not only be a coach, but to also deliver the news, if you will, whether or not someone's going to be successful when they want to retire from federal service. And they may have to make adjustments in terms of when they retire. They may have to consider other part-time employment or changing their lifestyle in ways that they really didn't want to.
Is there a formula for spending down the assets or which pot of assets to choose from first when allocating dollars?
When we sit down with our clients, Jason, of course we look at the annuity first because that's a steady stream of income for the rest of their lives. And so with that in mind, then, we can look at other resources that they may have available. For example, FERS employees who are retiring now should consider what they will receive from Social Security. That's another stream of monthly dollars. Above that, then, it does depend on the individual's particular situation. For example, do they have a mortgage payment still, or is the home paid off? Will they be moving to a lower-cost area? All those types of things are taken into account. But once we determine how much their annuity is, if they're going to have Social Security, how much that will be, we can then look at the different accounts that they have set aside for retirement purposes, such as thrift savings plans and individual retirement accounts, to determine how much we may be able to withdraw from those accounts on a monthly or periodic basis so that they'll have enough income.
Bob, if people have questions or want to learn more about First Command, where can they find you?
They can go on our website, and that's www.firstcommand.com.
Bob Hill, District Advisor for First Command Financial Services. Bob, as always, thank you for your time.
It is my pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss AFGE's recent TSA election victory with Local 777 President Ricky McCoy.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Ricky McCoy, president of AFGE's TSA Local 777 in Illinois and Wisconsin. Ricky, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, brother. How you doing?
Great, great. Now, last week, Ricky, AFGE won its historic TSA union election. Talk about what this means to you.
It means a whole lot. You know, we finally get a voice in the workplace. We finally get an opportunity to have some concerns heard, you know, at a national level as opposed to the local level with the AFSDs and the FSDs, Federal Security Directors, things like that. It kind of legitimizes us as far as Department of Homeland Security goes, because we are like the only agency within Department of Homeland Security that doesn't have collective bargaining rights as until that day. So it means a whole lot, man.
Rick, when you found out the news, what went through your mind?
It was crazy because I was at work that day, so I was actually waiting. I was waiting on the count, and, you know, I'm sitting around waiting, and I went on my lunch, and I actually started reading a comic book, believe it or not, and my phone started buzzing. I looked at it, and when I saw, like, AFG wins, I was going crazy. We was all jumping up and down in the break room, but then one of the supervisors came and said, "What's going on?" I said, "Oh, we just got the election numbers back." He's like, "Okay, just shut the door." It was crazy. I mean, it was overwhelming a little bit, you know, being here 9 years, you know, being with AFGE, like 8 of those years, fighting for this stuff, things of that nature, and to finally have it coming to fruition, man, it was just wonderful.
And how did some of your members in Local 777 there in Illinois and Wisconsin react to the news?
Oh, it was crazy. Everybody, they still calling me now, waiting for a party, you know. So I told him, I said, "Man, you know, that was the easy part, the election, because we all knew what was going to happen, you know. We were with AFG for a reason. We knew AFG was the quote-unquote team to be with, you know, I mean, just look around the federal sector, especially DHS. So we knew it was going to happen. It was just that anxiety of waiting on it. So when everybody finally came and said, you know, it's official, we won, these are the numbers, everybody, both states, it was just back and forth, phone calls, emails, texting. You know, it was just great, great all the way around.
Rick, I know you, and you're the kind of guy who likes to get right down to business and get to work. As a local president for AFGE's TSA members, what's your first order of business that you'd like to see taken care of?
The first order of business, of course, would be the GS pay scale, but realistically, that's something that will take a little bit longer because, you know, Congress has to be involved in that. But mainly, TSA's, the management directives and the policies that we abide by from state to state, airport to airport, even terminal to terminal, you know, it's not one accord. You know, everything is so different. It's hard for an officer to do his or her job when you don't know what rules you're going by. We have an SOP, but they don't follow it. So I was happy that the administrator gave us the opportunity to sit down and kind of hash some of that stuff out to take some of these words such as may or may not, you know, because supervisors and managers, when it comes to a word like may or may not, it's always going to be may not for them. So for us to have the opportunity to sit down and really kind of like right that ship, that's really what's most important. Because, you know, I tell the members all the time, it's one thing to get paid for what you do, but if you're getting a decent amount of money to do a crappy job, it's really, you know, it don't equal out. So for us to be able to sit down and like get into those policies and those management directives, me personally, you know, you're probably going to interview some other people that won't feel the same way, but I think it's more important that we get our work life right, and then the money will be okay. You know, AFG track record with the GS pay scale is phenomenal. So that's something that we really don't have to put too much thought in because it's already etched in stone. But to get to be able to sit down with TSA's management and kind of right that ship as far as those management directives and policies are going, that's what I'm really looking forward to.
Rick, talk about the unique situation that you have in Chicago working at O'Hare's Airport.
Well, it's unique in Chicago because we're a union town. You know, we're a union town. Like I tell everybody, if you're in Illinois or Wisconsin, it's either AFG or the Teamsters. So it was unique for us because things that couldn't happen in other airports, we were able to get a foot in the door because of the brotherhood, you know, with the AFL-CIO. And that's real unique to us in Chicago. I know we go to D.C. all the time, and we always talk about what we're doing in everybody airports. And when I say some of the – when I talk to the guys about some of the events and things that we're having, like we had a march up here where we just got all the brothers and sisters from the unions together, and we walked around the airport. That had never happened before in Chicago. And it was a TSA event. And all the people from the plumbers union, you know, the welders, bricklayers, they all came out. And, you know, that's one of the unique situations that we have being in a quote-unquote union town. You know, you really get the help from the big brothers and big sisters. They come out. You know what I mean? Because TSA O'Hare told us verbatim, nah, y'all can't have no rally. You can't have no walk. You can't do none of that. So I just went over to the Teamsters building, got with those guys, sat down with the plumbers and the carpenters. They said, okay, Rick, you can do it. Just give us the stuff. And you guys walk with us, y'all get in the front, and everything was great, you know. It's really unique being in a union town, Jay. You know, I tell everybody, if you're in one of those towns where the union has a big presence, you got to reach out to those brothers and sisters because they're willing to help, you know, but you got to ask for it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE TSA Local 777 President Ricky McCoy about AFGE's TSA election win. Ricky, especially in Wisconsin, which is an area that you represent, unions have been under fire, and a lot of legislators have been trying to silence union voices. How important is this election win in fighting back against anti-union sentiments?
Oh, it is real important, especially for Wisconsin, because, you know, they were going after the state employees, and we had to, you know, fellowship with those brothers and sisters to let them understand that, hey, they're going after you guys, but we're actually about to bring almost 2,200 federal employees into a collective bargaining agreement. So we had to make sure that our presence was felt more than ever in Wisconsin to let those legislators know we know how the game go. You're not going to start with the state guys and then move your way up to the federal. We're going to come at you as a whole so that you know we're all in this together, you know, and it's real important that people understand that it's not just a state thing. It's not just a federal thing. You know, it's a union thing. They're attacking unions. And any way, shape, or form that you can help somebody, even if it's just your leafletting, passing things out, walking, door-to-door knocking, we have to get out there and show that support. Because that's the only way we're going to get these politicians to back up. You know, I tell people all the time, I understand they have a job to do, but you are not going to bring all this trouble that's in America down on unions, you know, and it started in Wisconsin, it trickled over to Ohio. You know, I know it's probably going to make its way to Chicago, but they're going to have a hard time coming here. But, you know, it's real important for people in Wisconsin to understand that it's just not a state thing. It's not a local government thing. It's a union thing as a whole. And, you know, those guys out there with the farmers and things of that nature, the dairy farmers, you know, we walked out there with them and let them know what was going on and how it was going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, it's still prevalent, but they know they got a fight on their hands now, so.
Rick, earlier in the segment, you discussed a little bit about the desire to get into the GS schedule and away from, of course, PASS, which
right.
is TSA's pay-for-performance model. Talk a little bit about PASS and what it does to the worker.
Well, what PASS is, first of all, our pay system for TSA is man-made. It's a band as opposed to a scale. So that PASS, it's intertwined with that pay band. What PASS is, we have to be recertified every year and be proficient in the X-ray and our practical skills, which are the PSC evaluations. But those two components are 60% of PASS. So if you come to work every day on time with your uniform creased, know your knowledge and skill and all that, that's only worth 40%. If you don't pass your IMAs with a score of 90% or better, you don't pass your TSEs with a score of 90% or better, you're not going to get a payout bonus at the end of the year. As opposed to the GS scale, you're ranked on a certain scale. Maybe it'd be GS 5, 6, 7, 8, what have you. Then you have step increases. You don't have step increases. The pass is, I'm glad you asked me that question, Jay, because with the pass, that money is always budgeted out at the beginning of the year, and it's a lot. They have budgeted like $22 million for PASS. But if you go back and check at the end of the year after payouts has went to all the officers and everybody under PASS, it never equals to $15 million. Where does the rest of that money go? You know, and that's one thing you have when you have these man-made pay for performance scales. You know, there's no way you can track that stuff. You know, that's why I tell everybody all the time, PASS look good when you're a 1-2 year officer, because your first year, you're not even going to have to take the test because you've been certified coming into the job. But after you've been here for like 2-3 years and you get with one of these lazy supervisors who don't want to move, so if you don't do that job, they're going to ding you on your score, then you start to see that there's no transparency in the past. You know, it's really like, it's one of those things where like if you do it, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Because I've been here 9 years, PASS has been around like 7.5. The first 2 years I got role model, which was like a $4,500 bonus, 2.5% increase. But if you think about it, they give you that $4,500 in a lump sum payment. Almost $1,100 goes back for taxes. So, you know, you're taxing a bonus, and then the 2%, you really don't get that, because if you stop working, you don't see that money. So that's something real. You know, PASS is a sticky situation because you can go to some airports like these smaller airports where they only got 9-10 officers. These guys think the world of PASS because their supervisor and their manager, they're in a small town, so they all like, you know, they're all pretty much on the same block. As opposed to when you go to these large airports and you start to expand, first of all, the supervisors don't even know how to grade PASS. They turn their PASS into somebody else. And then this individual will say, okay, you got to go back and change this, change that, and then you can give this person this score. That's not how pay for performance is supposed to be. So, you know, PASS is one of those situations to where we have to get rid of it. There's no way you can make it right. I mean, it can only get worse. PASS can't get any better.
Rick McCoy, president of AFGE's TSA Local 777. Rick, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you to our guest this week, Congresswoman Donna Edwards, Campaign for America's Future co-director Roger Hickey, First Command Financial Services District Advisor Bob Hill, and AFGE TSA Local 777 President Ricky McCoy. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View for Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife.